Good morning, everyone. I'm Mel.
And I'm Pippa. We're the creators and editors of Earthrights, the podcast and platform that focuses on the connection between human rights and environmental issues.
Just a quick message before we begin. The views and research presented on this podcast are either our own or referenced on our website, www.earthrights.co.uk. We generally always record a few weeks ahead of release, so some facts or situations may have changed during this time.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the Earthrights podcast. Today will be one of the first of two bonus episodes on post-war reconciliation and peace processes. Today, we're in conversation with Ovida, a Sri Lankan national currently living in Prague. And today we're going to be talking about the ethnic conflict and post-war peace process happening in Sri Lanka and the human rights impacts associated with this. So Ovi, please can you just tell us a bit about yourself first?
Hi, so thank you very much for having me. My name is Ovida Gunasekara and I'm a Sri Lankan national currently living in Prague. In Prague, I'm currently working in finance, but like my original background is actually from law and public policy. I had my bachelor's degree in law from the University of London International Programs, and then I did a master's degree in public administration in the University of Colombo, Sri Lanka. And then I moved to Czech Republic about 5 years ago and did my master's in applied economics in Prague. And then in Olomouc at the Palatsky University, I did my another master's degree in international law and European Union law. So my profession back home was actually in as an attorney at law. So this is kind of like a topic that has been very close to my heart, how the human rights situation and the ethnic conflict has been going on in the country for such a long time. So I believe that I would be able to present my personal experience as well as things that I've learned from both formal and informal sources and be of some sort of a contribution.
For our discussion today, we can consider the process of peace building as an aim to non-violently address the root causes of a conflict in a nation or between groups of people so as to avoid relapse into conflict. But I think also it's important to think of the post-war peace process as something that is can be extremely long, because the place is trying to undergo a sustainable and functional addressal to a conflict, so that it's not just beyond the conflict but also in re-establishing a society in itself without the tensions that originally existed. So I mean, that often means that there's got to be attention paid to the needs, practices, boundaries of all of the different groups involved. So that might be being respectful of the differing practices of indigenous communities or racial or religious, cultural practices, ethnic practices, ethnic disparities, class, etc. Like there's so many actors and factors involved. I guess it's worth mentioning that in the last 50 to 100 years, the concept of peace building has been centered around the United Nations Security Council. I mean, Ovi, I'm going to ask you about this in a minute as well, and we'll come back to it later in the episode, because this often causes a lot of controversy, given that there are only 5 permanent members of the United Nations Security Council. So the UN was established to obviously create peace and ensure that the world didn't fall into disarray in the way that it did during the World War II. But having only 5 members of a Security Council, those being France, Russia, UK, USA and China, means that, at least from my point of view, it makes me worried that there can be a huge exploitation of post-conflict societies and the populations that have already undergone such turmoil, but also that in trying to make decisions for a peace process to work, having only 5 members means that and 15 non-permanent members means that decisions can be vetoed extremely quickly.
Exactly, because what you were saying was like absolutely true that having just five members in the United Nations Security Council as permanent members, having these supernatural sort of power of veto, it has become kind of like a tool that the superpowers are kind of using to usurp rather than to protect these days, it seems. For an example, I believe that in the early years of the United Nations, the veto was kind of like a tool that was used as a deterrent so that none of the other powers would be able to like influence more. But unfortunately, it seems like nowadays it's being used so more often rather than enforcing something, but as a thing that is used to stop from any sort of progressive action from being happening.
Yeah.
So in that case, it seems like it is almost impossible for the United Nations Security Council to take a unanimous decision on anything as long as one of the superpowers has a vested interest. So,
absolutely. And that's part of that's one of the key issues in the peace building process, because, as I understand it, one of the key elements of such a process is that you give... you facilitate the nation that has been ravaged by war to regain back control. So it's got that you want the nation to have ownership of its process, of the peace building process, and yet so often that, as you say, is usurped, or the power is actually taken away from them. And of course, it's really important when given that in after a conflict, there's often huge insecurity and political uncertainty generally, and like the original political parties that existed, even the notion of elections, that's all often completely gone. And so of course it's important, and traditionally or most recently the way of dealing with that has been to have other nations or the UN Security Council come in and try and sort of orchestrate a new political and legal system to be made, new political parties to be constructed, etc., etc. But that gives so much power to these interfering nations and interfering parties in that very national or in what should be a very national process and decision making situation. And I mean, we have to pay a lot of thanks to lots of human rights organizations, charities, etc., around the world, who are also part of that peace building process, and they do so much in aid and in donor assistance in that rebuilding process. But it when politics is involved, and so often it is,
exactly,
it's very easy for these, as you say, superpowers to sort of take control.
I heard a very, very interesting quote about international law, that international law is not law, it's just politics. So in a way, it seems like all the time these imported solutions that are just dumped on any country where there's some sort of a conflict very rarely work, because most of the time the root cause is homegrown. So unless the solution is also homegrown, it rarely works whenever the intervening parties are not willing to look into that in that point of view, rather than imposing a ready-made kind of solution.
We will come to see that the concept of peace building is extremely complex, and as we'll see in relation to Sri Lanka, countries that are emerging from a conflict are hugely fragile, and the population is at the end of its tether, and it's a very complex undertaking. So ultimately, a resolution, finding reconciliation and rebuilding a nation can take a very long time, and also gives way for regression as well. It's not always a positive progress, but perhaps you could start, Ovi, by explaining about not only just what the ethnic conflict has involved in Sri Lanka, but also perhaps about why there is and has been this ethnic divide in Sri Lanka, and the sort of the context behind the,
of course, yeah,
the difficulties.
So So if I'm to talk a little bit about, like, in the beginning, or the human rights and the legal perspective of the concept of peace building, and then move a little bit towards the concept of the context of Sri Lanka. So something first comes into my mind, like, which was really well chanted during the recent Black Lives Matter movement protests in the United States. It's the saying went as, no justice, no peace. So I would say that this is a very important kind of concept or a saying, where we can identify, like, the role of rights, justice, and accountability, and their importance in cementing the concept of peace building. Because as we all know, for the peace to have between to former adversaries or to current adversaries, there are certain things that we have to think about. That there's always a past, and there's always a present, and always a future. That means between these two conflicting entities or adversaries, there must have been something in the past that had disturbed their peaceful coexistence and had put them in a path of conflict. And in this case, if you talk about the legal perspective, that always boils down to accountability and justice. So that means whenever someone has done something wrong to the other person, and as long as the parties believe that there is no consequence for those wrongful actions, and that there's no accountability or acknowledgement for those actions, then there will never be a lasting peace, because that's the bedrock where the trust in the peace or the system starts. So in that case, I believe having a proper system or a mechanism to establish justice for past wrongdoings, and a mechanism to have some form of an accountability, is vitally important to address the issues that happened in the past. And also, on the other hand, the human rights perspective. As we know, if we are living in a single society, both conflicting entities, both of us have to have at least some form of basic rights so that we can feel as equals. So in this case, I wouldn't say that equality in a socialistic kind of way, but more like having some fundamental rights that all the citizens in a society would enjoy, so that they would not be feeling as outcasts or second-class citizens. So in that way, having both human rights and justice, accountability, is vital to address the past and present issues in a conflicting situation in order to build a lasting peace. However, I would have to say that we are not living in a utopia. So that means there will never be a system where 100% accountability or 100% human rights will be exercised. So that as long as there is an agreeable compromise between the parties, that they will respect at least some portion of human rights and some portion of justice and accountability, and then they will be able to move forward for cementing the peace.
And I guess part of that justice and accountability, or the very first stage of that, is just an acknowledgement.
Exactly.
As between just two humans in a disagreement, you've got to start by acknowledging that the problem existed, and then
Indeed, exactly.
There's so much going forward, and often the process can stall even at that stage, because both parties don't want to admit that that they're doing something wrong.
Yeah, so Ovi, can you give us a bit more background kind of this ethnic divide, and what is the situation? Is there any kind of reconciliation for this?
If I'm to start talking a little bit about Sri Lanka as the country itself. Well, Sri Lanka is an island nation which is situated in Indian Ocean in South Asia, just below India. We are a very small island, to be honest, like 65,600 square kilometers approximately, which houses 21 million people. So it's, I would say that for a small island, we have a lot of population. And the important thing about Sri Lanka is that we have had a documented history that goes back to about 2,500 years and an undocumented history that goes even beyond to about 5,000 years. So the history of Sri Lanka is quite fascinating, and it has been a part of this global scenario for quite a long time. For an example, Sri Lanka was a very famous trading hub in the ancient Silk Route, where a lot of spices were exported, a lot of gems, ivory, and also other sorts of luxury goods at that time. So talking about the people in these countries, in Sri Lanka, we have a very diverse demographic. The majority of Sri Lankans, in about 75% of the population, are Sinhalese, including myself. And we have about 11.9 or like 12% of the population are Sri Lankan Tamil community. And we have about 9% of Sri Lankan Moors or the Muslim community. And we have about 5% of Tamils from Indian origin who had arrived in Sri Lanka during the colonial period and who are mainly based in the central provinces of the island. And we also have like a very tiny minority of European descents, the Chinese community, Indians, and also like the indigenous people, the Wadda community. We're talking a little bit about the religious background of Sri Lanka. It's almost split on the ethnic lines. Like 70% of the country are ethnically Buddhists, and about 12% are Hindu, and about 9% are Muslim, and about 7% are Catholics or Christians. This sort of ethnic and religious diversity has been one of the key points in Sri Lanka's history, because as I told you before, like our written history goes back to about 2,500 years, and it kind of starts in the arrival of this Indo-Aryan people from India and mixing up with the indigenous people in the country at that time, and then come creating this new ethnic group called Sinhalese. And at the same time, the Dravidian population in the southern part of India, also some people migrated to the northern part of Sri Lanka, thereby creating this Sri Lankan Tamil community. So in effect, these two communities had been coexisting with each other for thousands of years. This is one of the most fascinating facts that I see about Sri Lanka's ethnic conflict, that there had not been any conflict for more than 2 millennia. And it suddenly started to raise its head in the latter part of the history. So in that way, I can say a little bit about the pre-colonial history of Sri Lanka. That means like from the arrival of these groups about 2,000 years ago, and then establishing different regional kingdoms inside this island. And for a long time, these regional kingdoms had interactions. So at some points of history, there were one kingdom that was dominating the whole island, or sometimes it was more like having a central king in the country and having some regional rulers ruling different parts and ethnic communities. So in effect, I know this is not a very popular kind of opinion, but I would say that for a long time in Sri Lanka, there existed some form of a federal sort of rule where communities had their own rules and they were all together being obedient to a single regal entity. So that was kind of like the situation in Sri Lanka for a long time. So in Sri Lanka's case, the first Europeans to officially make a foot in the foothold in the island was the Portuguese. They arrived in Sri Lanka in 1505. So at that time, they were mainly looking for spices. So they didn't interfere much with the island's politics, not as much as the following imperialists, but the Portuguese were mainly focusing on the coastal areas of Sri Lanka, and they were mostly engaged in the trade with these regional rulers. So eventually, they started interfering with local politics and influencing these ethnic kind of dimensions. So the local kings were not very happy about it. And then they sought the support of the Dutch to take care of Portuguese. We have a saying in that way that we traded ginger for chili. That means the Dutch came in and drove the Portuguese away, but then the Dutch stayed and we had more problems afterwards. So in a way, the imperial expansion was kind of nonstop. So the Dutch ruled the coastal areas of Sri Lanka for a long time. And then eventually, like as a result of the I think it was the 30 Years' War in Europe, the Dutch had to secede all their colonial foothold. So that's how actually the British ended up in Sri Lanka at that time. And then for a long time, British also ruled the coastal areas of the island. And at that time, they gradually started to integrate some of the local population to work for them, so that they would work as kind of like overseers, like local representatives in the country. And here is the important thing. Most of the Tamil officials at the time who were working very closely with the British, they were kind of preferred because they were more in touch with the British at that time, and they were all mostly living in the coastal area, so they had very good relationships. So while the interior of the country was still kind of like a sovereign state, the British were like ruling around it. However, in 1815, at the time, due to some diplomatic and like local political problems that had arisen at the time in this central kingdom of Sri Lanka, the people rebelled against the local king, and they finally handed over the last remaining Sinhalese kingdom in the island to the British in 1815. So in a way, the British did not conquer Sri Lanka, rather the country was handed over to them. So it's kind of interesting because at that time, it's the kingdom was indeed ruled by a king or a line of kings who had Indian Tamil descent. So as you can see, the ethnic relationships at that time in the island was so intricate and complex that you couldn't have divided it as Sinhalese or Tamil, like black and white, rather than a complex web of communal relationships. So that's how actually the colonial rule in Sri Lanka started. And from 1815 up until 1948, the British ruled Sri Lanka for about 133 years. Talking about the colonial period, which I would like to identify as the time where the seeds of the ethnic disharmony first were grown, because as I said before, like during the initial British rule, they exercised this very famous tactic of theirs, divide and conquer. So it was very easy for them to rule the island if the people are divided. And the easiest way to divide the populace is to divide them on ethnic lines. And in the case of Sri Lanka, I think dividing people on the lines of Sinhalese and Tamil. So at the time, mainly the British rulers, they wanted some form of official class to maintain the day-to-day affairs of the state. So in that case, they wanted to find locals who are educated, especially in English, and who are very familiar with the Western kind of culture. At that time. So the obvious choice was to find some people who have learned English and who had been associating with them for a long time, which would happen to be mainly the people from the coastal areas. And by coastal areas, it was mostly from the rich elite locals who belong to the Tamil ethnic group, because they had been working with colonial rulers for a long time. So it was easy for them to get more integrated into the British rule and to carry out the imperial mandate at that time. So I would say like this applies to the Sinhala elite at that time as well. There were this sort of bourgeoisie who were learning in English and studying and living in United Kingdom for some time, stuff like that. So there were like Sinhalese elite who were also taking part in this kind of like a ruling exercise. But the majority at that time, the ruling class at that time, the official, the government officials, the judges, the lawyers, the doctors, like most of the like this well-established positions were held by members of the Tamil ethnic group. Which was the reason of the evolution of the imperialism. Like it was a gradual process. It was not like one day, like all the Tamil people were like ruling over the Sinhalese or anything. This had nothing to do with like the suppression of Sinhalese by a minority, rather than one group of people very quickly grabbing all the opportunities. Well, I don't think that there was any conflict among the common men as to who is ruling them, rather than a conflict between the ruling class as to who is able to rule the common man. So this was kind of like the starting point of these ethnic tensions in a way.
Yeah. And so how did it manifest into the civil war?
Exactly. This is actually a very interesting like a turn of events, how the timeline went on, because as you know, like gradually the British started to introduce the parliamentary democracy, the British democratic or like the Western democratic system to its colonies. So the first notable tensions between the ethnic groups started to manifest under the second or third constitutions that were introduced to the then Ceylon dominion, where the local populace was supposed to elect one representative to the governing council of the country, the governing council, and this person was elected by 4% of the country's entire populace, the vote of 4%. And this person was supposed to be, quote unquote, an educated local. So the contest among the this bourgeoisie at that time was to secure this one seat in the governing council to represent the populace. So it funnily enough, at that time, the Sinhalese population, the majority, was so divided based on these caste systems at that time, everybody ended up voting for a Tamil representative for the governing council. However, the problems started to gradually become worse when people wanted more representation. So as you know, when you get more and more representation, it's divided among the demographics. And that means the number of seats that were secured by the Sinhalese population started to increase as well, since they were the majority of the population. Unfortunately, the the majority of the educated, the governing class at that time were Tamil, as it was the status quo at that time. So then this friction started to appear, that the Tamil elite started to be a bit tensed or not happy that their status is being robbed by, at that time, the Sinhalese. So this went on for a while. And in 1931, we were given the universal franchise. Fun fact, Ceylon was the first British colony to receive the, I would say, privilege of universal franchise. There was even a funnier thing that it was in 1927 that the suffragette movement in UK secured the right for women to vote. And 3 years later, Sri Lankan women got the right to vote, you know, out of nowhere. So in a way, it shows the level of trust the colonial rulers had on Sri Lankan population, that they would exercise this democratic right in a much more responsible way. It was a success for some extent, I would say. So this universal franchise, unfortunately, was the main problem for the ethnic groups, because obviously it meant that the Tamil community in Sri Lanka would end up getting a minor representation in the governing council, or like at that time, I think it was not called the parliament, but it was called some form of the governing council. So this, from 1931 up until 1948, there was huge debate as to how the process of democracy has to work to ensure the rights of the minority at the behest of the encroachment of the majoritarian rule. So until 1948, when Sri Lanka was granted independence, this was how the situation was developing. And important thing about the 1948 independence is that we were not totally independent. That means in 1948, Sri Lanka was turned into a dominion state, much like Canada or Australia these days. That means the de jure head of the state is still the Queen of England, while the locals have a prime minister-led cabinet and a parliamentary system. So in this case, the main idea was that as long as the head of state or the head of the executive, that means the representative of the Queen, the Governor General, is not appointed from this normal democratic way, that he would ensure the rights of the minority people, minority classes. So this was kind of like a check in a way that was introduced under the 1948 constitution to ensure the rights of the minorities. So, but unfortunately, as we know, it didn't manifest in the way as expected. And since the independence from 1948 up until 1956, there was kind of like this situation where ethnic politics did not come into play much. At that time, like the political system in Sri Lanka was much more similar to the political system in UK at that time. That means we had these conservatives, party and a labor-led kind of socialist party. So that was kind of like the main political divide at that time. And both the ethnic groups, or not both, like all the ethnic groups signed on to each of these political parties. However, in the 1950s, unfortunately, the with the emergence of nationalism, the common man started to question the independence that we had. That means even though the country was technically independent, still the ruling class was the same ruling class that was ruling the country a century ago. And the foothold of the British was still there. And this really boiled up this sense of nationalism and this ethnic tension really started to emerge when the politicians moved away from doing politics based on, I would say, conservatism or socialism, and started to go towards nationalism. So in 1956, for the first time in Sri Lanka's history, there was a government that was formed not from the conservative or the socialist party, but as a joint venture of both parties, defectors from both parties, and which was based mainly on Sinhalese nationalism. So in 1956 election, this was the main event, in my personal opinion, in Sri Lanka's history, that brought the ethnic tensions into open. That one day the government and the whole government apparatus is dominated by the Sinhalese community. And adding insult to injury, in 1958, the government took a very populist move to pass a bill to declare that Sinhala, the language of the Sinhalese people, the majority of the country, as the official language of the country. So before that, it was the English that was the official language, and both the local groups like the Tamils and the Sinhalese had to kind of follow the English lead. But in 1958, suddenly the language became Sinhala. So it was like literally done within 24 hours in a way. And this really sparked a huge communal tension, and it resulted in a lot of communal violence. And I think it was at that time the Tamil political leaders, they decided that it would be almost impossible for them to have a say or to work hand in hand with the Sinhalese counterparts, and then the ideology of a separate homeland for Tamils started to emerge. Situation started to get really worse in the 80s when the then newly formed militant group called the LTTE, the Liberation Tamil Tigers of Elam, who were really ruthless in their exercise of power or their mode of operation, really shook the government and started to threaten the whole country and pushed the country towards a civil war in a way. So that was the unfortunate result of this 100 years of evolution of ethnic tensions ended up in this unfortunate ending. There was a ceasefire agreement that was brokered by Norway, led some other countries, between the government of Sri Lanka and the LTTE, the Tamil Tigers. So this was kind of like seen as a break in the violence, but unfortunately this was also turned out to be an important solution which did not recognize the real problems between the two communities. So it created even more problems, that the trust deteriorated so badly between the two communities that the peace accord or the ceasefire agreement did not last for more than 3-4 years. As soon as the then government was deposed and the new government was formed in 2005, the ceasefire agreement was over and the government went renewed its military operations. There was a time where the military operations really picked up, and at that time it appeared that a military solution was kind of the only a sustainable solution for this ethnic conflict, because the Tamil militant group, the LTTE, who was controlling the northern and eastern part of Sri Lanka at that time, who them declared themselves as representatives of the Tamil community, started to act more as a dictatorship rather than a real representative of the people. So at that time, so the civil war ended out to be a war to crush terrorism. I myself have experienced such incidences to a minor extent in my, I think when I was at school, there was this bombing that happened right near our city. And I live at the very bottom of the island. So that was it for me, like the war. But I imagine that it had been the same for ordinary citizens living in the northern and eastern provinces in their entire lives. And eventually, the Tamil Tigers were defeated, and the government forces, they succeeded in ensuring their control in the northern eastern provinces. And finally, in 2009, the military actions came to a halt. So kind of like the guns being silenced. But at that time, the international community was not very happy, I have to say, with how the war progressed. So at that time, there was several resolutions that were tabled in UN's Human Rights Council and the Security Council. But at the time, Sri Lankan government was very, in good terms with Russia and China. So the vetoes practically helped any further escalations. However, the UN resolutions were in effect a reminder that the international community was watching and that they were aware of the human rights violations that was going on at that time in Sri Lanka.
Would you say a sense of a peace process has been coming into being since then? And has that been, is that shaped by the UN or is that shaped by other groups, would you say?
So I have to say that, yes, in a way, the country has been healing. And surprisingly, not because of the UN-backed resolutions, more like both the ethnic groups were so fed up with the war for 30 years, nobody wanted to go back to that sort of like past. Yeah. So after 2009, like the communities has been healing. When I say healing, I mean in a very relative sense. That means people still don't trust each other. That means, like, especially since 2009, the government forces are still mainly stationed in the north and east. So most of the land that was held by the civilians at the time are still held by the military. Of course, there's a gradual process of returning this land to their rightful owners, but the process is pretty slow. Mm-hmm. And this slowness, in fact, has been one of the problems, because that means if the process of healing is slow, that means it's always easy for the illness to return.
It seems paradoxical in a way. One would, on the one hand, one would think that time can heal a nation. People have endured such a long process of conflict that, yeah, no doubt they can't imagine wanting that to reoccur. But it's so true that the living memory continues to live on, and we don't know how, people don't know how that's affected that even their inner physiologies, and that is then passed down generations for hundreds of years. So even regardless of the fact that people are wanting to move on, it's still within them. It's still part of them. And so part of the healing process, as we said at the beginning as well, is that acknowledgement even for each person.
In my personal opinion, I believe that what Sri Lankans, both Sinhalese, Tamil, Muslim, everyone, have to have or develop is a sense of empathy. That means we have to understand the feelings of our fellow neighbor or like our fellow citizens, because each and every one of us are citizens of Sri Lanka. And whatever happened during the war or even the time before happened to the ordinary citizen of the country. It's not something that happened to Sinhalese people or happened to Tamil people. It happened to Sri Lankans. So as long as we do not think as such, as long as we do not try to understand the pain and suffering that happened to each one of us, we cannot move forward. Because as we all know, in war, truth is the first casualty. That means we will never, ever be able to find out what really happens. There will always be a political narrative behind it. So in that case, it is paramount that we as a nation has to acknowledge that every ethnic group suffered, that every ethnic groups had losses, and that the end of humanitarian operations in 2009 was not in fact a victory, but just an end to the war. So we have to acknowledge that there was a problem and both sides suffered, and we have to move together as a one nation rather than different ethnic groups. So that would be my opinion and my advice or plea for the future generations to come to find a solution so that we could sit together, find justice, find accountability, and find human rights, and move on.
If you are interested or concerned by any of the issues raised during this podcast, then please get in touch at contact@earthrights.co.uk or visit our website www.earthrights.co.uk. You can find full recordings of all of the episodes on most podcast platforms or on the Earth Rights website, referenced in the show notes. We host a blog on there too, as well as recommendations and other information. Please also join in on the journey by following our Twitter and Instagram accounts @earthrights_.
If you would like to be involved in an episode of the Earth Rights podcast, then please also get in touch. This Earth Rights podcast was hosted, produced, and edited by us. Music and sounds were specially made for Earth Rights by the Mowgli Wild Boys, who are currently recording a new LP at Circuit Studios in Nottingham. Please follow their Instagram and Facebook @Mowgli Wild Boys.